this week. Investors cheered the election outcome. The Dow Jones Industrials picked up nearly 1,000 points, a new all-time record. Welcome back, everyone, and happy Veterans Day. Your host, Chris Waltzik. With you again this weekend, the U.S. presidential election stunned over 150 million Americans. The former underdog Donald Trump trumped the establishment and the elite by securing his position as the 45th president of the United States, winning the electoral vote but not the popular vote. Joining me this week with their take on the election and just what it might mean for all of our portfolios, Dr. Stephen Lieb, bestselling author and head of The Complete Investor, returns to the show. We discuss Hugo Salinas Price's latest comments that a deflationary trend could spark a new round of QE by central bankers, leading to a new gold rush. He's been watching the 25% rally in base metals, including copper, which flew higher this week. He continues to be one of the most vocal and outspoken proponents of China. China leads the world in cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin and Litecoin, and we've created our own silver bit, which represents approximately a fraction of a real silver coin, only 21,000 silver bits in existence. My Alpha Stocks newsletter subscribers are eligible for a base number of coins, and future bonus loyalty coins, you can actually exchange the silver bits for a silver coin once a silver price threshold is met. Then Jeffrey Nichols returns to the show, senior economist of Roslyn Capital, has big comments on the safe haven investments. Populist and protectionist movements around the world are gaining momentum. The U.S. election is similar to the Grexit and the Brexit. That uncertainty will almost certainly boost demand for gold and silver. We also discuss the hyperinflation ravaging Venezuela, where a carton of eggs can cost $150. Just one more reason to keep the world's best money in your portfolio. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Cloudy skies appeared over the precious metals market as money flowed into risk-on trades as the U.S. greenback moved sharply higher in the wake of the election outcome. Gold finished off $80, 6%, finishing at $12.24 an ounce. Silver dropped 99 cents, finishing at $17.38, off 5.4%. The precious metals XAU shares fell 11 points, 12%, closing at 78, while black gold was off 66 cents, 1.5% per barrel, closing at $43.40. The top story moving the markets was the presidential election outcome. President-elect Trump will be inaugurated in January. The U.S. dollar rallied on increased expectations of that quarter-point rate hike. Now there's about an 81% chance of a rate hike in the December or at the December FOMC meeting. Plus, the explosive move in the blue-chip equities drew attention away from the precious metals this week. Investors are anticipating increased investment in infrastructure by the new administration, improvement in roads, airports, bridges, ports, trains, and related projects will likely boost demand for base metals, including copper, which flew higher this week to a 16-month high on hopes for a U.S. construction revival, had a weekly gain of 11%. Meanwhile, on Thursday, St. Louis Fed President James Bullard noted the U.S. election result will help break gridlock in Washington, D.C. The Fed only needs to bump interest rates up just a bit. It's very close to its targets of full employment and stable inflation. Plus, weekly jobless claims fell this week by 11,000 to a one-month low of about 250,000. Precious metals, bottom line. The top story driving the markets was the greenback rally as well as U.S. blue chips, which just simply drew all the attention of the markets. Clearly against these trends, precious metals will have to consolidate for a while and find a floor. Visibility was virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange as volatility subsided following the elections. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 960 points to be exact, 5.36%, ending at 18,847. The S&P 500 picked up 80 points, 3.8%, ending above 2,100 for the week, while the NASDAQ Composite added 190 points, 3%, at 50,46. Investors were pleasantly surprised by Donald Trump's presidential win. The market settled into business as usual, and all eyes turned to corporate numbers and earnings reports, which included NVIDIA, the video card supplier, which spiked 17%, following blowout third quarter earnings and a 22% increase in dividend. The graphics chip leader Advanced Micro, AMD, leaped 4%, while Nordstrom jumped 2% at the open on solid third quarter earnings announcements on Thursday. Coal miner Console Energy, CNX, added 2%. Bottom line on equities. Well, the VIX volatility index returned to the mean, as well as the 7-indicator sentiment index, as greed overcame fear in the markets this week. The Dow is at an all-time record closing high. Few warning signs abound for the time being. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio with our two big guests. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Today's featured guest, Jeffrey Nichols from Roslyn Capital. By now, I'm sure our listeners know that Donald Trump is the 45th president of the United States. It was nearly a landslide victory in the Electoral College, where he surprised pundits early this morning with a marginal victory in Pennsylvania that secured 20 votes. U.S. equities sold off sharply, as expected, and safe haven assets benefited, including the cryptocurrency Bitcoin, which gained 3%. Joining me in this discussion, Jeffrey Nichols from Roslyn Capital.
Well, Chris, it's good to be here with you today, particularly at this historic moment in the nation's economic and political future. The election results, I think, underscore the importance of gold as an investment and particularly as a safe haven with good price prospects in the years to come.
I share your sentiments, and I think it's really underscored by the turnaround or the sea change event that we saw in the last 24 hours. I mean, virtually all the major polls were virtually unanimous, just like the Brexit episode that just stunned the markets, as well as, I think, people around the world.
Here, you know, the Brexit and the U.S. results overnight, I think, underscore a global trend towards more protectionist, more populist tendencies in both the major European countries and the United States, and probably if you take a look at the Asian markets, you'll probably see a similar tendency towards protectionism and populism at the same time. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why gold should benefit from this turn of events. First of all, we have tremendous increase, I think, or recognition of uncertainty in financial markets. And if there's one thing that gold thrives on, it's uncertainty. And we're likely to have not only uncertainty for the moment, but uncertainty for at least the next few years. We don't know what Donald Trump really represents in terms of economic and social and political policies. That's yet to be discovered. He's expressed many views on many things, some of them contradictory. So we have to just see how he's going to sort out his priorities and what type of policies he's going to pursue. And we just don't know the answer to that question yet. I expect markets will react with the same sort of volatility that we've seen in the last day or two.
Is there anything else that you'd like to discuss with regard to the presidential election outcome and the ramifications and potential reverberations that might be felt throughout the markets before we move on to other topicality?
Well, let's just sort of bullet point some of the main issues and sources of uncertainty that now appear more likely as a consequence of the election. First off, we're likely to see greater volatility in foreign exchange markets, with the dollar going up and down with more force and vigor than it otherwise would. It's going to increase interest in gold amongst some investors, not only as a safe haven, but as a currency that is free from political maneuvering. And I think that's why many people like to hold some gold in their portfolios because it just does reduce that sort of risk positive for gold, not just in the near term, but probably for the next few years at least.
Exactly. And there just really are question marks about the safety, security of financial instruments. As I mentioned, cryptocurrencies getting quite a nice bump after the election outcome. And that has been a theme. You know, after Hugo Chavez, the latest president, Maduro, doesn't seem to have a handle on the economy. Venezuelans now are facing the opening salvo of hyperinflation. One article showed a carton of eggs, 12 eggs, cost approximately $150. Price explosion due to the bolivar's depreciation, and they just don't seem to have a plan that can work.
Well, I would just make the general comment that it illustrates how gold can protect against the erosion of value in currencies, whether it's the Venezuelan currency or someday it may be the U.S. currency. You know, we've had really over the last several years a very expansionary and inflationary monetary policy. We've had seen the creation of billions of dollars, literally, in dollars by the Fed and the printing presses, and ultimately that's going to come home to roost in terms of higher prices for consumers throughout the economy.
Talking about higher prices, potentially a 20,000 bolivar note or bill, if you will. Grocers and storekeepers will not accept bolivars at face value. They only accept bags of bolivars, which they promptly weigh and then give an estimate of the potential value.
Reminiscent of the German hyperinflation in the early 1900s, when people were running around to stores looking for food and other necessities with wheelbarrows full of Reichmarks.
The $100 bolivar note is now comparable to a dime or a 10-cent piece here in the United States. And this just really unfolded 12 to 24 months, depending on what you choose as your starting point.
Flames of inflation in Venezuela were stoked much earlier when the country was really under communist leadership, was promoting social change, which seemed like a good idea at the time, but undermined the currency in the longer run and had laid the groundwork for the problems the country is now having.
It sort of outlines just how quickly that the specter of runaway prices can emerge in almost any economy. And Venezuela has long been viewed as the gem of South America. They face this atrocity that just eviscerates the middle class. And the only real solid asset that seems to have protected anyone other than cryptocurrencies are the metals and real tangible goods.
Really, that we're not going to see a hyperinflation of the sort we have in Venezuela now or that we had decades ago in Germany. But nevertheless, there will be rising inflation and rising inflation expectations, a consequence of the monetary and fiscal policies of the last several years. And we're beginning to see that already. I mean, one reason stock prices are so high and real estate values are so high is because the creation of money, while it hasn't flowed yet into consumer goods, but it has been fueling inflation in certain asset markets, equities and real estate come to mind. And when the confidence in the government's ability to manage the economy diminishes, I think we'll see these other asset markets sell off, and that monetary creation that's taken place over the last several years will express itself in terms of higher consumer prices affecting all of us. I'm probably among the more bullish in terms of price prospects for gold and other precious metals. And I think it's important to understand that it doesn't depend solely or entirely on U.S. economic and political developments. But remember, gold is traded and priced in a global market, and what happens outside the United States can be just as important, if not more important, than what happens inside the United States. And my feeling is that we're going to see continued strong demand for gold in the Asian economies, particularly India and China, both of which, for different reasons, have historic interest and attraction to gold as a medium for savings, long-term savings. And when people in those countries buy gold, it often will never come back to the gold market. It's a subtraction in the available supply of metal. When we see higher demand come from the United States, all this money that's gone into gold in China and India is going to, in a sense, come home to roost.
Once the elemental crosses China's borders, it truly enters the event horizon and rarely reemerges. The singularity, of course, is the result, at least partially, of the PBOC and government regulations on the export.
It's against the law to export gold from China, but it's perfectly legal to import it. And so we've had a net flow of gold into China that's never going to come out to the world market again, not in our lifetimes at any rate.
Of course, China, like the United States, interestingly, I'm going to make the parallel here, has a history with silver as the backing for its currency, a silver-backed currency. It'll be interesting to see whether or not that changes. And if it were to change, I think we would see a surprising increase in demand for silver.
Could very well be. But for now, the interest really is in gold. And it's not just the private sector, which is buying more gold, but the official sector in the form of the central bank, which month in and month out is buying 15 to 20 tons a month, is continuing to do so. And interestingly, it's the other communist country, Russia, which is doing the same thing. And I think this represents an effort by government authorities in those two countries to reduce their reliance on the U.S. dollar as a reserve asset and enhance their own currency's prospects to serve as a reserve asset in however the world monetary order sorts itself out in the next few years.
I would only add that I think these moves that you've outlined here almost lend themselves to a scenario where silver becomes almost invaluable relative to its current price, because as the central bankers and the powers that be, and you know, obviously the PBOC, continue to accumulate in India as well, let's not forget, massive amounts, eventually, you know, 2 to 4 billion people in the periphery who just cannot procure gold simply due to the cost, which I think could make silver absolutely a must-have asset.
Exactly.
Okay, let's move on to the latest Labor Department report. We saw another robust jobs number. It wasn't enough to impress investors, even with their 191,000 revision from the following month and the drop in the overall national unemployment rate down to 4.9% from 5%. Just wasn't enough to excite the markets. I mean, clearly, folks are starting to realize we've had this at least official recovery from approximately 10% unemployment down to sub 5% levels. And I'm starting to think that contrarian and institutional deep pocket investors recognize, you know, where do we go from here? Can this downward trend persist after such a long period? Are we at the, you know, the nadir of the cycle and a higher unemployment and recession is in our future?
The unemployment rate, as it's published, is only part of the story. The labor markets have been unable to benefit a whole swath of workers who have lost their jobs over the last decade and have subsequently dropped out of the labor force because they don't see any opportunities for themselves. We're talking about millions of people who have, in a sense, been left out of the economic expansion that we've seen in the last few years. This is one of the reasons why Donald Trump has done well, because he's appealed to this disaffected millions of workers who remain unemployed and have little hope of finding a job. Monetary policy is also sensitive to that issue and has been leaning towards low interest rate policies and reflationary policies as a consequence.
What you just outlined is probably the deciding factor in the presidential elections in the last 24 hours. In fact, in the exit polls, you may have read, it was the number one, I believe, issue. Jobless rate. I mean, we essentially have 100 million able-bodied Americans, or let's just say working-aged Americans, who are capable of meaningful work, who are having difficulty finding it or have given up altogether.
I think that there's a whole array of issues that will result in the Fed pursuing low interest rate, high monetary stimulus policies for some time to come. As you mentioned earlier, there had been talk of an imminent interest rate increase by the Fed this December. But I think given the results of the presidential election and the uncertainty of economic situation as a result of the election, the Fed is likely to undertake continued stimulus for longer and not raise interest rates as fast as they otherwise might in the next year because of uncertainty about the U.S. economy, fear of toppling it into a worse recession than we may already have at our heels.
No, exactly. Our analysis jibes. It aligns perfectly with your thoughts there. While I do suspect there's still higher than average odds that we will see an interest rate hike to 75 basis points on the overnight lending rate in December, and we've been calling it for many months, there's just no hint of any rate hikes in 2017. I don't think we'll see it. We'll likely see the Fed's balance sheet, which has essentially been flat now for a year or two, increase in the coming years to offset uncertainty and volatility in the economy.
It wouldn't surprise me, in fact, if we see a sharp decline in Wall Street equity prices, see the Fed actually intervene in the stock market in addition to prop up asset prices for equity investors.
We've heard recently from Jim Rickards, who's been calling for $10,000 gold. Actually helped with the long-term capital management bailout, you might recall, in 1998, as well as helped officials in 2008. He sees something even more horrendous on the horizon and has revised his $10,000 target to $50,000. Do you think there might be some substance to some of these targets?
Well, I don't think any of us really know how high gold may go as it moves higher in the next few years. But I think we can be fairly confident to say that it's going to move up substantially. I myself think we're going to see prices for gold more than double in the next few years. The upside potential is certainly more significant than most observers outside of Jim Rickards believe, in part because of what we talked about a few minutes ago. Demand coming from the big Asian markets of India and China, which is not really factored into price prospects. In the wake of the Trump election victory, we are already seeing increased uncertainty in financial markets, and that spells higher gold in the weeks and months ahead.
The dollar has sold off sharply. If this trend continues, it could break the back of the two-year consolidation, which would support your thesis of a new uptrend in the precious metals, mm-hmm. because this, as you, I think, really alluded to early in our discussion, is a currency story, at least for the most part, tied to global currencies. And we haven't discussed this, but in terms of most major global currencies, gold is near relative highs in recent months, whereas with only the greenback, I think you'd agree, maybe the yen, we've seen some stubbornness. So this election just might be what precious metals aficionados needed for a happy new year.
Well, let's just say we have interesting times ahead. Your readers should remember that I'm senior economic advisor to Roslyn Capital, which is a retail gold investment firm that I highly recommend for those who are looking to increase their, or initiate, I should say, as well, their precious metals holdings. Well, I just suggest they give Roslyn Capital a call and begin a discussion on the how-tos and such of holding gold, whether it be in their overall portfolio or their IRA and retirement accounts. I have always advocated that there's a place for gold in every investor's toolkit, and that 5 to 10% of investable assets should be held in gold as a insurance policy against the various risks we've been talking about.
You know, I think that's just really the key. We experienced a very strong downdraft, but it really balances U.S. equities particularly very well in a portfolio. So the point there is when you have a big down day in the U.S. equities markets, as we're seeing today and recently, for the most part, the precious metals tend to offset that loss.
You know, also, I would say that investors should hold gold and hope that it doesn't go up. And it doesn't go up, it means that the rest of their investment assets, the other 80 or 90% of their investment assets, are doing great. And that's what we should really hope for. But prudence dictates that we have some insurance in case we're wrong. That insurance is in the form of some physical gold, as I said, 5 to 10%
right.
of investable assets is what we typically talk about.
Yeah, it's well said. And I would only add, during unusual times, during strong themes, as we're seeing in the precious metals, not just in the United States, but, you know, around the globally as well, you can increase your allocation. You can comfortably do so. It's prudent. It's wise. Well, we thank you for your time and look forward to having you back on Gold Seek Radio.
My pleasure.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers. Plus, their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Okay, we're so glad you're back with us for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, Dr. Stephen Leib from The Complete Investor. Dr. Stephen Leib, over 25 years of investment experience, author of at least 7 books. I think there's one right now on gold that should be hitting the shelves pretty soon.
The gold book that will be hitting the shelves, I don't know if it'll be very soon, but it certainly will be hitting the shelf. If I stay off the shelf, it will be on the shelf.
The Trooper today on Super Tuesday, recovering from double cataract eye surgery, one of which, some complications. Dr. Stephen Leib, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. It's always a pleasure talking to you. It really is. I mean that sincerely.
Kind of you to say. And I thought we could start off today with Hugo Salinas Price just penned an article. Of course, he's the head of the Mexican Civic Association for Silver. There appears to be a deflationary trend, which seems hard to wrap one's mind around, at least in the metrics that our central bankers like to watch. He thinks that this is likely to set off explosive money printing, which could lead to more inflation, a big plus for the yellow metal.
I'm not sure why he thinks deflation, but, you know, one chart that I am looking at right as we speak is how base metals have done this year. And base metals have been spectacular. There's no other word for it. The year started off with a thud, you know, from China. I mean, it looked like China was going to implode. It did not. Basically, base metals in the first 2 weeks of the year, as the stock market did, as almost everything else did, they declined, I would say, you know, about 8%. Since that low in mid-January, base metals have gone from, and I'm looking, when I say base metals, I'm looking at six metals that are traded on the London Metal Exchange. I think that's probably the best and broadest measure of copper, zinc, aluminum, nickel, and the like. It's a very, very comprehensive index of base metals. And it's not different than iron ore or anything else in terms of how it's performed. But, this is up from 2000 to today, about 2600 or 2578. You're talking about a 25% move in base metals this year. And no one is talking about this. This is really, you know, it's extraordinary. And I think a lot of it does have to do with China, you know, stockpiling some of these metals, et cetera. And basically, I think it's, you know, the steady but inexorable return of not return but inexorable growth in the East. I mean, Chris, it's remarkable to me that the West, where we are now, seems to be in just total denial of what's happening in China. I know that, you know, it's not going to be straight up for China. There's going to be some sort of turbulence as they, you know, segue from one type of economy, I guess, dedicated to exports. Although, you know, that exports are going to come back again as in terms of what happens in the East. But as they try and segue away from, let's say, these state-owned enterprises, I really think that that's a little bit more precise, which have been bloated, which have been given a lot of favoritism, et cetera. But they're getting away from that, and they're putting a lot of emphasis on the private sector in their economy, especially when it comes to refining and other things, too. And they are really emerging as the center of a massive Eastern economy, an economy that really encompasses like about 4.4 million people, well more than half the Earth, just potentially enormous. It's this so-called One Belt, One Road project she introduced in 2013. It wasn't really she. I mean, he was the one that sort of got it rolling. But, I mean, this has sort of been on the Chinese minds probably for, I don't know, hundreds of years. And it had been mentioned by previous presidents as well. Basically set to touch 64 countries, try and knit them together in terms of infrastructure, both by land and by sea. Again, 4.4 billion people affected. And just in terms of quoting Bloomberg here, you know, it's not so, you know, it's just not my hyping the thing. But the estimates are it'll be roughly 12 times bigger in dollar terms than the Marshall Plan. You know, if you think about the Marshall Plan after Europe and rebuilding, a good chunk of Europe, this is 12 times larger. This covers, you know, much more than half the world. It's off the ground. I mean, it's starting to go. I mean, China, for instance, now owns the Piraeus port. I think I'm totally mangling the pronunciation of the port. It sits at the foot of Greece, and it provides a maritime gateway to Europe, to Eastern and Central Europe. as well as to, you know, Russia, et cetera. And it's just one example. Another port and another huge major project going on is this corridor through Pakistan, which will end up on the Arabian Sea. And it's like $50 billion project. People just don't know about this. But, you know, you look at this massive uptrend in, I mean, you know, our stock market is, what, up 4 or 5% this year? I mean, is there anything, any asset class that you can think of if you ask people? Well, you know gold is up. But the fact that base commodity, iron ore hit $70 the other day. I mean, huh? I mean, wasn't iron ore supposed to go down to 30 or 40 because there was such a, you know, a massive oversupply, et cetera? No. And what's remarkable about some of this, especially iron ore, is that it's happening without oil. I mean, oil has been actually not a bad performer this year. I mean, lately it's been a little disappointing, but it's still up about 20%. OPEC has to get its act together, and I think that they will. And when they do, and you see oil sort of join in the gains, I mean, you know, you've got commodities going just, you know, could really start accelerating. I mean, bear in mind, at the beginning of this century, you had a massive move in commodities that was predicated on the development of about 1.4 billion people, China. And that development continues. I mean, there's still a lot of roads to be built in China. There's still a lot of urbanization that's going to happen in China. Still a lot of trains that are going to happen in China. I mean, car, you know, forget the exact numbers, but their cars per capita in China are far less, I mean, you know, a fraction of what, and electric cars. And, you know, it goes on and on and on. China is still a very, very much a developing economy. They're sort of upper middle class in terms of worldwide standards, but that means that their per capita income is probably, what, a quarter of ours, something like that. They've got a long way to go. But other than China, the rest of the East, which is 3 billion people, they're just starting. So if you think about this, this world is changing and we're not even noticing it. It appears like we're in total denial. I mean, and it's not just me. Again, I'm quoting Foreign Affairs. They had an article, the first major article that I have seen by a credible news outlet was Foreign Affairs. And in their one of their two most recent issues, I can't remember which. And they said we're the first ones to talk about this project, 12 times the size of the Marshall Plant. They urged the United States to get involved, start having hearings. I mean, Congress hasn't even mentioned this. I mean, everybody's, you know, attacking everyone else's character while China continues to build out the most impressive by far. By far the most impressive, what will be the most impressive infrastructure project in the history of mankind. So, I mean, where are we? What are we doing? You know, her proposals for infrastructure are $250 billion, $250 billion. That won't be enough to repair, you know, what happened in this country over the past, I don't know, how many hundreds of years. Our infrastructure spending in this country is back to where it was in 1950 in terms of as a percentage of GDP. Where are avenues for growth? I don't get it.
We share a passion for the rousing tiger nation, in particular in the way that the culture has sort of morphed itself. And now opening the door a bit, and, you know, China, as you may know, Qin is their word for wall. I mean, the whole idea of China, yeah, the Qin dynasty, the whole idea there, a giant wall from the rest of the world, we must protect ourselves and isolate ourselves. That wall has been, of course, there's some new doors, doorways there. I mean, here in the West, we're not embracing the amazing lessons that we could be learning. Instead, we are, actually, it's really becoming a vilification, is at least that's what the mainline media seems to be putting us direct opposition, I think, with what could be one of the greatest learning and growth opportunities in our national history. We've covered this in such great detail in virtually almost every discussion. Let's answer some of the concerns coming from many different sources outside the mainline media. Firstly, the pegging of the yuan or renminbi to the U.S. dollar, and I understand there's some flexibility there now. Many folks have been concerned that this gives an incredibly unfair advantage to their exporters relative to ours, acts as a tariff or a severe tax on the United States.
Well, I think that China basically is letting the market more or less tell the renminbi what to do. I mean, it is more or less pegged it to a basket of currencies, and it seems to be following that basket fairly with a great deal of regularity. I mean, I don't think that they're... Look, there was a long time. I don't think that that's really a major issue. I think that the renminbi, I mean, you know, exports are nothing to write home about as far as China goes. And I think the renminbi has been under some pressure. I think that in terms of whether or not China should raise or, you know, cause the renminbi to reflate, but I know that they've been, you know, spending money, keeping it more or less where it is. I think that there's downward pressure right now on the renminbi, and I think that we have to hold ourselves to some extent responsible for that downward pressure. I mean, China's trying to fight pressures to lower the renminbi, you know, keep it steady. And I think part of the reason you have these downward pressures on the renminbi is that we're in denial about what's happening in China. That's why people want to sell the renminbi. They believe all this debt that's in China is going to come home to roost, and they're going to have a terrible problem. People want to get out of the renminbi, and they want to buy the dollar. So I think you have a lot of natural forces right now. This is not China. This is basically the guts of my guts of the defense of this kind of argument that the renminbi is undervalued. We're the ones that are undervaluing it, not China. China's basically using its own money to keep the renminbi where it is. And it's, you know, basically speculators that have come in, bid it down. I don't think that'll last, incidentally. I think the renminbi will go up on its own. And I think that, you know, you'll have a whole new monetary system probably built around the renminbi, but the renminbi and gold and maybe the SDR, et cetera. But, you know, as to your, again, emphasizing how I would answer your question about people being cynical about how China is manipulating its currency, it's not China that's manipulating the currency. It's people, traders outside of China that are bidding it down. What can they do about it? I mean, you know, in order for them to get the renminbi up to a level that would, say, flatten out their trade surplus, I mean, they'd have to spend all their foreign reserves. I mean, you know, it's silly. It's not them. It's us that are doing it. And it's us that are doing it because we're not paying attention to what China's doing. And it does, you know, and everything tends to, you know, sort of tie together. If people were a little bit more conscious of what was going on in the East and how China is centering itself in the East, I think that they would be less inclined to sell the Chinese currency. I think they'd want to own it, especially now that it's a member or part of the SDR, it's received IMF blessing, et cetera. But again, this is not China's doing. This is, if it's anybody's doing, it's America's doing. It's America's, you know, again, all you read, when you think of China these days, you think of a mountain of debt that is insurmountable, which is just ridiculous. It really is. They have this very much under control. And you don't think of a country that is really dynamic and doing things that is seizing control of the East. So, you know, that would be my answer. It's not China's doing, it's our doing that the renminbi is as low as it is.
I wonder if you'd like to address concerns that the demographics in China might actually work against it, at least relative to their neighbor, India, where it tends to be a younger component to that demographic group, and that this could actually hinder economic growth in China relative to India in the years to come.
I think it might. I think India over the next 5 or 10 years could be a faster growing economy than China. I don't see that as being a big deal. Fine. You know, India is starting from, you know, such a low base that it will take many, many years to catch up. And I think that the fact that China's working age population may start declining, if it's not already declining a little bit, will encourage more productivity from that country. I mean, you know, China has tremendous room to grow its productivity. Productivity right now is about where America's was, I don't know, in somewhere in the 1930s. So, I mean, they have just fantastic room to grow their productivity, and they're doing a lot of things that are right. In terms of that, I mean, another thing that hasn't caught anyone's real notice is this supercomputer virtual currency issue. It's amazing to me that if you go back 10 or 15 years, there's a list, I think it's compiled by MIT, but it's certainly a very credible list, the 500 fastest computers in the world. And, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, the United States had 250 on that list, by far the most. Today, the United States has 165 and China has 168, which is just extraordinary. I mean, really just extraordinary, and even more extraordinary in that we recently cut off exports of Intel's chips, you know, high-powered, high-performance chips to China. So this is all now homemade in China. And not only do they have more supercomputers than we do, but they have by far the fastest supercomputers than we do. So what does this have to do with the price of eggs? Is this sort of just China thumping their chest showing we can do this? Not at all. Because if you look at the nature of virtual currencies, such as Bitcoin, you see that they are very intensively mathematical. And they require incredibly sophisticated cryptographic patterns in order to, you know, create them. And it's very, very difficult without, in fact, it's not possible without, you know, incredible, intensive computer power to do this. And that's why it's such a very, very attractive type of way of let's say, trading goods between countries. Because you know, break the key. It's almost impossible, basically. I mean, there have been a couple of successful hacking attempts, but they are sort of far exception to the rule. And the way the currency has been set up right now, it's virtually, you know, nearly hack-proof. Now, guess what percentage China has of the trade in virtual coins? What percentage of the market does China control of virtual currencies, which are basically going to play a critical part in today's world, especially when it comes to trading among countries? About 70%. I was shocked when I heard that number. Shocked. But then when you think about it, the advantages China has is that they have built the fastest supercomputers, and also they have an abundance of cheap energy in terms of hydropower. And that is where, you know, these big, big computers are very difficult because they use so darn much energy. And China basically has a lot of free energy because I think they have by far the most hydropower in the world. You know, it's just water flowing. And they're using that to power a lot of these computers. And they just have, I think, well, I don't want to say nothing's insurmountable, but it appears that they have a major, major lead in what is going to be a vital part of our monetary system here to come. And that's virtual currencies. And, you know, you combine that with gold in some form, which I think is nearly certain because China's on record as saying that gold is part of the Chinese dream, literally. I mean, that's a literal translation from the party secretary in charge of gold. And the PBOC has been very much in favor of backing virtual currencies, backing gold. So you're going to have some sort of a coming together of virtual currencies, possibly the SDR, and gold. Now, it's very possible. I mean, you know, my best guess, and this is just a guess, is that China really doesn't want to be the single reserve currency of the world. They just don't want it. It's a hassle. But what they would probably like is for gold to be part of the SDR as, let's say, a sixth component The yuan was, I think, the fifth component, and they would like gold to be the sixth component and go from there. And they would like to manage the SDR as a virtual currency as far as trade goes. Now, that's going to take fantastic amounts of computing power. And China will be the one, you know, the center of the stage without having the actual reserve currency. That's a guess, Chris. But it's not a guess to say virtual currencies are here to stay. They're going to play an increasingly important role in the world. China right now dominates. I mean, really dominates. You talk about a franchise, they've got it on virtual currencies. Basically, are, you know, been accumulating who knows how much gold. I mean, anybody's guess is as good as anybody else's. They are, you know, in a position to basically be the center, certainly, of the Eastern monetary system. Whatever system is there in the East, it'll be yuan, gold-based, or SDR-based, which will also be yuan and gold being the center of it. Take it from there. Gold's going to go up, and I think the dollar's going to have a much, much lesser role in today's world. I think it's inevitable. I don't even think it's open for, you know, debate, to be very honest with you.
You've directed the discussion into a favorite domain of mine, cryptocurrencies. It's ironic that you'd mention the thought of a precious metals backing, or a melding, if you will, with cryptocurrencies, because this weekend I coded up a silver-backed cryptocurrency. I've issued 21,000 tokens, if you will, or coins, if you like. It's called Silver Bit. Now, here's the concept behind it. Each bit or coin has 0.10 backing of a silver dime, a U.S. silver dime. There are only 1,000 silver dimes physically stored. And the concept is very clear. You would want to accumulate 10 silver coins, and then at any time, the owner can request physical delivery, but they have to pay for shipping to the mint. There is a mint master, i.e. humble me, can change the number of coins in existence, if you will, or the supply in circulation at any given moment, due to the increase or decrease of silver in circulation around the world. And these are right now only being offered as loyalty points, if you will, or tokens to my subscribers and new subscribers. Ticker is, let's see, SLC. And if you receive them in your wallet, in your crypto wallet, it will say Silver Bit, depending on which one. Now, the Silver Bits have voting rights. We're using those as shares. That's a crowdfunding idea. But back on point here, the whole idea of cryptocurrency seemed a bit like a flash in the pan. And then suddenly we have these devices that I've been involved with, up to the S9 Bitminer and Antminer. Very energy intensive. In China, many of these mining companies have free access to free energy. I mean, no cost whatsoever.
But that's what I was saying, because of the high energy that they are the leader in by far. I mean, they have massive hydropower.
I'm not sure that even the powers that be have fully woken up to, but I suspect that you have, and a few listeners in the audience, and even this middle-aged mind is starting to wrap itself slowly, ever so slowly, around this cryptocurrency thing. This is reminiscent almost of the tulip mania, because, you know, what made the tulip bulb so amazingly valuable is no one really knew exactly what they would get. Would they get the variegated strain that was worth $100,000, or would they just get the regular, you just never knew. They didn't breed true. Well, I suspect we might be looking at something here, a whole new, I don't want to use the word paradigm, but ontology. This is a completely different world. And obviously, Dr. Greenspan, who just poo-pooed the whole concept, it has no intrinsic value. It's virtually worthless. You know, all this.
I mean, you know, it's easy to do. I mean, how could he should be the one that should be easy. He's the biggest gold bug that ever lived, probably. He probably makes me look like a gold hater.
I think he inadvertently made one of the best cases for the cryptocurrency, because I don't think he thought about the fact that essentially most of our currencies today really have no backing at all.
And they're easy to hack. I mean, you know, they've proved that the methodology for transferring money among countries, you know, that are doing trade with each other can easily be hacked. And if you look at what, I mean, you know, I kind of get depressed thinking about this. But if you look at what China and Russia, I mean, you know, they're very close in a lot of areas. I mean, cyberspace is one of the areas in which I don't know whether they directly cooperate. For all I know, they hack each other. I'm sure they do to some extent. But I'm also sure that there's a lot of cooperation. They are so far ahead of us. It's ridiculous. It's why did that happen? How did that happen? How is it that China is a clear leader in supercomputers? How is it that China can spend, what, a year and a half in our personnel management getting records on everybody with high-level clearance? And we don't even have any smoking gun to this. How is it that they're able to hack the DNC? I mean, they seem to be able to go wherever they want to go.
But you've actually supplied us with the answer when you talk about how can they do this. Probably rhetorical on your part. I mean, how can they do this? Good question. It requires to factor those primes that are required to do the hacking that you referred to, a supercomputer of unimaginable power.
That may be part of it. And also it requires a sort of dedicated educational system, which we don't have in this country. I mean, a friend of mine whom I've known for quite some time and has, you know, a wonderful background in Russia. He was one of the leading chess coaches in Russia. In fact, he was the youngest merited chess coach in Russia, and he was Jewish on top of it, which, you know, is extraordinary. So he was really, really tops, and he keeps in touch with what's going on there. What Putin does, I think, I don't know, six times a year, is he'll gather a bunch of the best young students in Russia. I mean, Russia's education system, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's not very good. But it's exceptional when it comes to looking at gifted kids. I mean, my friend, for instance, I think was one of 30 or so that was selected for, you know, the most elite school in St. Petersburg when he was like six or seven. And, you know, they're doing, oh my goodness, they're doing algebra in first or second grade. I mean, you know, by the time they've gotten to seventh grade, they're doing calculus. And the best of these, the best of the best, and the same thing in China, are singled out. They're given, you know, a lot of privileges by the state, and they work on what they love doing. And the state and their families are incredibly well compensated, taken care of. They're very well compensated, et cetera. And, you know, out of this comes, you know, people that are just, you know, our kids or young men or young people that are just extraordinarily skilled.
I mean, I think this has been an ongoing discussion since Bobby Fischer. I mean, we're talking 50 years. You know, it was astounding how there was that mechanism in place and all the support, and they would take care and groom their chess masters and chess masters to be. There was an apprenticeship program.
Michael was part of it, my friend. Yes, he was, because he was so good, he was given a lot of special privileges. Not enough to keep him in Russia, but he lived a very, very good life there. And he was part of that entire system, and it was gigantic. I mean, it was part of the Russian, you know, ethos that, you know, intellectually they were so good because of, you know, their chess. And Fischer really literally defeated an entire system. I mean, it was quite extraordinary, and he did it very much on his own.
Yeah, I suspect he had pretty severe Asperger's syndrome, and as well as, you know, he was hyper-accusive as well.
And in fact, if we do things right, again, I think the United States can, they're never going to be, we're not going to be number one anymore. I mean, I think that's, those days are over. But as far as Venezuela goes, no, my guess is, and it's just a guess, they have that heavy oil, and they have a lot of it. I would give more than even money that it will be China that more comes to their rescue than the United States. And the way they come to their rescue is that they help Venezuela develop that very heavy oil. And they will, of course, get a very big chunk of what comes out of it. And, you know, some precedent for this is that when China, you know, first decided to make oil a strategic interest, one of the sets of leases that they bought were from Venezuela. So I think that they've done business with Venezuela. I think they're familiar with it. My guess is the only reason they may not have acted up to now is that they have such a full plate, you know, dealing with the East and, you know, managing their own transformation, et cetera, et cetera. But my feeling is China will play a major role in resuscitating Venezuela, you know, over the next, it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, you know, their situation is really dire, as you pointed out. I mean, a lot of starvation, et cetera.
The 100 Bolivar note, or okay, you think of it as their dollar, if you will, is worth less than a dime. It would be one thing for a dollar to be worth a dime, another thing for a $10 note to be worth a dime. When a $100 note is essentially worth a dime, we're looking at exponential price explosions. Grocers, shopkeepers, absolutely refuse to accept currency other than in bags, and they weigh them. In other words, they will not accept your word for how many bolivars you have. And one commentator noted that that is the precise moment, whenever that occurs, such as in Central Europe as well as Zimbabwe and other places that have experienced this, and South America as well, maybe it wouldn't unfold this way here in the United States or in Europe, because there is a big push to do away with our currency. I understand that there's less than 20 or 30% of our dollars actually are in physical form, and I know you've read story after story about officials pushing towards a cashless society.
I still think we're probably a little bit off in the future in terms of that. But yes, and I think that kind of thing is very, very likely. But you know, the story with the Weimar Republic is very, very interesting. Once they pegged their mark, or whatever they called it, the Reichmark, I'm not sure, they actually pegged it to their own land. Things got a lot better almost overnight. They spent the last half of the 1920s being a pretty good economy. You know, fairly steady growth, not much inflation, you know, fairly decent. I mean, the problem Venezuela has is that they just have no growth on top of this, you know, incredible inflation. But they are very, very rich in assets. I mean, tremendously rich in assets per capita. And, you know, that's a recipe for somebody coming in and rescuing them. I just don't think that we see it. I mean, this I think that they represent a great win-win situation. I mean, certainly the major winners will be the populace of Venezuela, but also will be the people that the country or countries that help rescue them and help develop this heavy oil, because it's there. I mean, you know, if someone like me who can see that it's there's a clear path to, you know, getting Venezuela out of this jam, there's definitely. And our problem is, unlike China, as you brought up, Chin, I think means wall, you said, or Chai. Chai means wall. China doesn't ever judge other people. I mean, they do business with whomever. They're certainly not going to judge, you know, the Venezuelan political crisis. I mean, if it's an opportunity to do business and if the Venezuelans can be helped, they're going to be there. And my guess is that it's sitting as a memorandum on either Lee or Xi's desk right now as we speak. And you know, I think China will be there. I mean, again, I think the one thing that's been stopping them is that they have an awful lot on their plate with the plenum or whatever, however you pronounce it, you know, being in progress and, you know, this transition to a new Politburo. They probably haven't had a lot of time to, you know, really do that. But my guess is that it will be a role that China fills, or at least takes a big part in filling over the next couple of years. In getting back to China, a psychologist, retired now, but he's still a chair and emeritus psychologist at University of Michigan, Nesbitt, did all these studies comparing Eastern and Western cultures. I guess the classic one is if you show somebody in the West a picture of something, their eye focus goes immediately to the center. They want to know what's there. What is the center of action? But on the other hand, if you show someone from the East the same picture, their eye focus goes to the periphery and sort of works its way in. They want a complete sense of what's going on and how things are interrelated. And I think we've got to get back to that kind of mindset, and I think it is possible. I mean, again, like with supercomputers, about 15 years ago, China did not, I mean, they had one mediocre grandmaster, okay? Anybody that's a grandmaster is a great chess player, don't mistake me. But among grandmasters, he was very mediocre. He was toward the bottom of the list. Today, out of the top 50 chess players or so in the world, they have six. And the average age of those players is something like 22. Russia has a comparable number, but the average age of the Russian chess players are probably around 34. The best game that was played last year in chess was played by a 16-year-old Chinese player. It was just a totally remarkable game. So, yes, they do things like, you know, center, chess, et cetera. And they also do Go very well. Yeah. You know, They do things very, very well because they focus on what it takes to do things well.
They do, and I concur with your thoughts, but I'd also point out that we're doing some interesting work here in the United States using GPUs, or graphical processors.
Look, we're at a terrible disadvantage in this country because our goals, and I tried to make this point recently, we're basically focusing on our wants. We want to be the very best at everything, and we're not really focusing on our needs. Our needs are to protect ourselves. We don't protect ourselves when it comes to cybersecurity. We don't protect ourselves in a lot of ways. In China, for example, they're focused really on their needs. They don't want to control the world. I mean, they want to be the economic center of the East. That's their want, and their need is to simply protect themselves. And therefore, if you look at their weaponry, I mean, they're not trying to develop weapons to conquer the world. They're trying to develop weapons, and they've already succeeded. I mean, this J-20 stealth fighter is just a remarkable piece of weaponry. But it's not designed to conquer the world. It's designed to protect China. They have a stealth submarine, and they have hypersonic missiles. So, you know, the question that stumped Trump, I guess, in the debate about, you know, the threefold way of attacking, well, they have a threefold way of defending. And they can defend by land, sea, and air with the best. They're, you know, stealth fighters, they're stealth submarines, they match us. We can't go in there. I mean, we have no way of getting in there because they could destroy our aircraft carriers by land, sea, or air.
But think of what it's telegraphing. Again, you know, the world's greatest, much more so than with chess. What you learn is every time your opponent moves, that individual really transmits an enormous amount of information that must not be ignored.
The number of chess games may not exceed, maybe, you know, a fraction of the number of Go games, but they're still large enough to probably amount to the number of molecules or atoms or maybe even elementary particles in the universe. I mean, you're talking about something like 10 to the 40th possible chess game. So it's not just a game get the king.
I was just trying to underscore the importance of their defensive strategy. Remember, we're keeping with that China concept of we don't need to dominate the world militarily.
Exactly right. That's where I think is a good point to leave off, because that is what their edge is. That is really what their edge is. We want to dominate things. We want to control things. They don't. They want their populace to live a very good life. And I think if we can, you know, do a little bit more of that in this country, we could still be a very, very good country, a great country again. My view on gold, very simply, writ large, you know, the United States started downhill in the very early 1970s, almost coincident with the time we went off the gold standard. We remained the reserve currency. We had more than it was like a child just given as much as money as he or much candy as he could ever want. We used that money and candy or whatever you want to call it in just terrible ways. And our whole focus, which had been, you know, more or less long term, became shorter and shorter term. Now you see nanotechnologies, et cetera. At the same time, beginning with this century, a new power emerged with a completely different philosophy, really a philosophy that sort of harkened back to how we thought about things, you know, in the 100 years preceding 1970. They're taking over things, and gold is very central to their ambitions, and there you have it. You're going to have a massive, massive bull market in gold. The dollar, I think, is going to, you know, be a much reduced role for the dollar in the world, if any meaningful role at all. Gold will be the asset of choice, along with silver and other precious metals. But anyway, that's a very, very brief one-paragraph summary. As always, I really, really appreciate it. You know, hope we can talk soon.
Dr. Stephen Leib, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. It's always a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. One of the topics I address in my paid business speaking engagements is leadership in a changing world. Now, my fees for a 45-minute talk are a small percentage of what we've learned some political leaders have been charging their donor clients for a similar length presentation. But fortunately, we don't have to rely on WikiLeaks to decipher and understand the essence of the leadership message. Because leadership in a changing world is precisely what is needed right now, more than ever, now that the 2016 presidential race has concluded with the election of Donald Trump as President-elect of the United States of America. Those who stayed up into the wee hours of the morning on election night were greeted with an authentic brand of leadership when Donald Trump delivered his victory speech. It's subtle. It's the kind of leadership that one sees practiced in many of the most successful organizations around the world. What exactly did Donald Trump do? He systematically acknowledged and gave credit for his success, not to himself, but literally to each member of his team. Go back and watch it on YouTube. He did not pass victory off solely as his success. He did not act as a prima donna. He gave ownership of that victory one person at a time to his dedicated team. It's the mark of a great CEO. It's what defines an excellent administrator, and I believe is an integral part of the recipe that is required for leading this country and the world. A skillful leader, an effective president, must master the art of people magic. Not that people have to agree with everything a president says or does. We know that will never happen. But what must happen is that president, that leader, must inspire loyalty, respect, and commitment from those he or she directly works with and relies upon for the implementation of their vision. I went back and watched the victory speeches of several previous presidents, Yes, they recognized and gave credit typically to several key people. But for the most part, it was about them. There was a distance, a separation from the voter that could not be ignored. Regardless of your politics, Donald Trump exhibits a rare embodiment of intuitive leadership qualities. One by one, he bested and defeated 16 other Republican contenders, a feat that will be analyzed and spotlighted as more and more people realize they have been living through the most historic political period of our time. Over my lifetime, the Republican and Democratic parties have become more and more alike. And over the past two decades, in many ways, they have become indistinguishable. Two sides of the same coin. This establishment of two political parties always feared what we were led to believe would be a viable third party, when in fact they have both always feared the emergence of a true second party, an alternative to what has been, in essence, a single party rule. That second party emerged from within and has redefined the political landscape for some time to come. Nothing illustrates this more than the vitriolic split between establishment Republicans and their party's nominee, Donald Trump, who has risen to the top. From a leadership perspective, President-elect Trump has been tireless and precise in winning against his opposition. He wouldn't be the president-elect had he been anything else. Now we need to stay focused on what will be a different set of leadership qualities that have started to emerge. The kinds of qualities that will be required to bridge the gaps, create the dialogue, and find the common ground that so many are looking to discover. Chris, I'd like to direct our listeners to visit my website at conquerchange.com and join my new email list. I've been gearing up for some time to release new content and special features, which are just around the corner. So please direct your browser to conquerchange.com and sign up today. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at conquerchange. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment venture. Bank and founding director. Their Sal George project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Rhea project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.